Welcome to the Scrum.org Community Podcast, a podcast from the home of Scrum. In this podcast, we feature professional Scrum trainers and other Scrum practitioners sharing their stories and experiences to help learn from the experience of others. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello and welcome to the Scrum.org Community Podcast. I'm your host, Dave West, CEO here at Scrum.org. Today's podcast, I'm actually really excited about it because it's a topic that I care deeply about. It's on product ownership. Fantastic. And I'm excited to have Ralph Yocum, one of our PSTs, join us for this podcast. Some of you might know Ralph from the book he co-authored on product ownership with John McGrill, an awesome book, one of my go-to books whenever I'm annoyed with my own ability to do product ownership. Also, he's obviously a bit of a leading light in the area of product ownership. I've known Ralph from his tireless efforts in our community on improving our product ownership curriculum. In fact, he and Don authored our PSPO class that maybe you attended and have been instrumental in improving professional Scrum from the moment I've been here over the last 9 years. I consider Ralph to be my friend, confidant, and sometimes counsel, maybe too often counsel. Welcome to the podcast, Ralph.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. So before we get into the content, because you know, we could talk for days on this. Perhaps tell our listeners where you're speaking to us from.
I'm based in Bern, Switzerland, so center of Europe, but it doesn't belong to the European Union. That's the specific thing about Switzerland.
I know. And also, isn't it like, wasn't Einstein born in Bern?
Einstein was actually born in Ulm, Germany, but he used to work for the patent office in Bern, and he came up with the relativity theory while he was living in Bern. So there's a museum, you can visit the house, you can sit at his desk essentially where he had these marvelous ideas.
Incredible. Hopefully you sit occasionally at that desk to get good ideas around product ownership and management. Okay, let's get into the content. And it's a topic that I'm really interested in. So you've been talking a lot recently, and certainly we've spoken about it, about this thing called the product management vacuum. Maybe you want to, what is this product management vacuum?
If you think about it, I'm just basically every organization has a vision where they want to see themselves 5 years down the road. And then they take this vision and they think about what does this mean for us, and they translate that into a business strategy. So let's just assume organizations are capable of doing that. Now, if you go further down, I think if we would have all the facts, everything exactly what we need to do, we now have the engineering practices and the possibilities to deliver on that. But what happens between we have our business strategy and we know exactly what to do because we know how to do it? And this is a disconnect. And it's really translating the strategy into the tactics, kind of the operational thinking, the doing. And we all know, maybe remembering from physics class, that a vacuum has this strong need to fill itself. And if we're not careful, yes, it will fill itself, but often with artifacts, things we all remember, because that's our classical project mindset. So we might have a charter, we will have milestones, then we would have our classical reports on time, scope, budget. Now, this project mindset is really, really strong, and it develops its own dynamics. And essentially, if you are now a project manager, delivering on the plan, on time, on scope, on budget is more important than customer outcome. We nailed it. We made the thing the customers really needed. They love it. And this is really what Don and I describe in our book as the vacuum. And this is, for me, where product ownership really comes into the picture, because product ownership connects the business strategy all the way down to the implementation and makes sure this vacuum doesn't basically exist by, you know, essentially as a product owner, you would then know about what is really the strategy of the organization. If you haven't understood that, you couldn't really act on it. Otherwise, you would just get a plan and follow that, and you wouldn't be a product owner. So you take that idea from the organization, you think about it, and you come up with a product vision. This could be a new product or maybe a new version of an existing product. Once you have that vision, that becomes your North Star. That's what we want to achieve, because that's a small part what we can do overall for the organizational strategy, company vision. And then once you have that product vision in place, you think about how can we achieve that? And that's the product strategy. Now, instead of writing everything down and then again throwing it over the wall to the developers, because they know what to do essentially from an engineering point of view, it's really that you then connect to them and you give them the same understanding about why you want to do what you want to do. And once they have that understood, and in Agile, we all know that self-organization, self-management is a really important aspect. And once they have understood that, they can start to act on it on their own, because now they have the understanding to do that. So what I often like to call the mental, the cognitive alignment, so that we really kind of on the same understanding. Because an example I often bring is like, close your eyes and think about a tree. Now I see a big oak tree, which basically was growing in the street when I was a child. Now everybody sees another tree, and that's the cognitive ballast we bring to our work. And we have to really talk about this and get this understanding lined up correctly. And this is what I really think about. This is product ownership, all about taking the idea from the organization, thinking about it, translating it from the strategies into operational tactical things, and then working closely with the developers so that they know what they should be doing.
But hang on a minute, Ralph. I just need to, so organizations, classical organizations, maybe we would say today, the ones that haven't gone through this transformation, aren't product oriented. They take a strategy, and then there's this 6 months of ridiculous, like lots and lots and lots of meetings. In fact, I was in Switzerland, not unfortunately, and I was in Geneva, and I was chatting to a guy that runs supply chain for a large consumer packaged goods organization, and he says, well, our planning process takes 9 to 12 months. And it starts literally, it doesn't, and it, the next year's planning, the next horizon's planning starts actually while we're still in planning for the previous horizon. And we're in this continuous planning process, et cetera. And we, you know, horse trade, and it's all about resources and what can we do? Are you proposing a different, do we still do that big, like 9 months of horse trading, or is it a little bit simpler now in this product to fill this vacuum, as it were?
Yes, so there's a totally different thinking behind an Agile. And I think this is where most organizations really struggle. They want to have the benefits of Agile. Like, you know, I have this big biceps and my six pack, but I don't work out. and really to get there, you need to change the way your organization is really thinking and acting on that. And essentially, in a classical way, what you just described is the organization is often broken down into functional silos. So we have maybe a strategy department that come up with something, and then they pass on some documents to the next department. They work on that and they pass it on to the next one. Now, this is really a lossy process. Information gets lost along the way. Understanding gets lost along the way. And I think we all remember maybe the telephone game when we were children, like, you know, it just passes 10 kids and suddenly the message is something completely different. So there's information loss, and this is what we really want to change in the way we work in Agile. Instead of being driven by activity, where essentially the batch size is everything. So we plan everything and then we analyze everything and then we design everything and so on. We want to turn this by basically 90 degrees and just say, no, what is the first most important customer outcome we should aim for? Well, maybe even talk to the customers. Is this right? Would you think that would be not okay for you? And if they give us the thumbs up, then we think about how can we demonstrate that functionality? And we would do a little bit of everything, a little bit of strategy, a little bit of analysis, design, implementation, testing. And then this is where essentially the feedback loop in Scrum comes into the picture, because then in the sprint review, we could show working product instead of just, oh, this is a document. Is this good? It looks nice. Yeah. certain slice of working product. And this really changes the way also we work with requirements. Now, this is my personal opinion, but I think Agile really wants to get away with stop doing classical requirements engineering, because of it, instead of writing those large documents where everything is codified, essentially. This is what requirements engineering, in my opinion, is about, codification of knowledge. So I swap my understanding onto paper, someone else reads it 6 months from now, and voila, they have exactly the same understanding again. But it doesn't work like that for the reasons we just talked about. So instead of doing that, we start to collaborate with each other. And this goes back, if you think about the Agile Manifesto, customer collaboration over contract negotiation. So we would talk to them, then we would get together with the cross-functional team. So not just programmers on the team, but also business analysts, user experience designers, what else you need. Deliver on that, show it to them, and then they can give us feedback. Yeah. Maybe their feedback is like, wow, this is really nice, but actually not what I was looking for. And then we can just say, okay, great, let's talk about that. Let's figure out why this is wrong, get this understanding. And this is where I really think because we operate in the complex where we have the unknown unknown, so we can't know everything up front. There will always be surprises. There's this model about there's the circle of control, circle of influence, and everything else. So even if we would do everything perfectly in our circle of control and influence, there's still the entropy around us. And I think we all have experienced in the last couple of years what that could mean. So instead of really trying to make the big plan, we work a lot with the narrative, the understanding. So because something happened in the past, which makes us think we need to change something so that our future is better. And the future is better plan, that's how I think about our strategy. It's like a vector pointing in a specific direction to the vision we have. But in the end of the day, if you really think about strategy, happens today, every day, again and again, by what you do. So if the people have the understanding, and with people I mean the Scrum team and everybody who has something to do on this product, if they understand the past, the problems which have triggered why we do what we do, and understand what's really anticipated, they can deliver on that. And then we really get into this closed feedback loop, because in the end of the day, we cannot prevent mistakes. If we always play it safe, I believe as an organization, you will eventually disappear in the big sea of mediocrity. So we have to take risks, educated risks. And if we minimize, if we manage to minimize the time between making a mistake and learning from that, that's brilliant. Because and in Scrum, it's usually, let's say, 2 weeks now. So we do something, 2 weeks later, we know, nice, it was right, or oops, we get a slap on our wrist, and we can figure out what it was, improve on that. Maybe adjust our strategy slightly, because we have new insights, new learnings.
So hang on a minute. So ultimately, we have a company strategy, we then determine the investment that we'll make in each particular product, which will then determine determine how much effort we're putting in each product as an organization, which then will determine how the strategy will then be used by the person that is in charge of those products, the product owner, we would say, to determine what actually they're going to do in that product. So we seem to have simplified the process massively. But tell me, which is amazing. And then we start working. We start delivering small increments of understanding, of learning against that strategic vision in the context of the product that we're investing in. And that tends to work. You know, in our class, we talk about the three Vs: vision, value, and validation, right?
Yes.
So how do those three Vs really work? Because you got this vision, and then you still got to decide, you know, which, and then ultimately we're going to be delivering stuff, and you have to validate it. What, how does it all fit together, Ralph? That's something that you talk a lot about. Can you share with our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. So the three V's is this, also it's kind of like the three main sections in the book from Don and myself. So vision is really about what is it what we want to achieve. I always believe, and I think this is a nice thought to have, because with the work we do, we make someone's lives better. And if it's just five clicks less, their lives has improved in that regard. Maybe they can get home earlier and see their children or something. So whatever we do should have a positive outcome for someone. Yeah. And that's the vision we want to achieve. And the vision is then basically, if you work as a product owner, that is the vision of the product you want to implement. Now, the value is really kind of where, think back to the product management vacuum, because this is really where we want to find out what is the most valuable thing we could be doing right now. And this really is like opening up, bringing everything. What is the market doing? What is the competition doing? What are our users telling us? Is there, could be anything. And then we think about all of that. And then in that context, we try to find out what's the most valuable thing to do for our users, again, by talking to them. And essentially, then we go ahead and we deliver this small increment of product. I like to think about it of those vertical slices. And now, a little bit of a step back here is that because we work, classical project management has this belief that if we have enough information, we can plan everything 100%. But if this would be true, moon missions, Mars missions would never have failed. No, there's always, you know, the things which can go wrong because they're outside of our control. So it's just the reality. And because of that, a linear approach, a defined approach will never really work in those environments. And that's where we want to work with an empirical approach. And empirical approaches, they work through feedback loops, guided by experimentation and learning. And that is what we need to leverage. And I don't want to go too much into complexity theory right now, but in complexity theory, there's this concept of an enabling constraint. So an enabling constraint doesn't prevent accidents or bad things to happen. It's just, it's like a rail guard, like a car, you know, if you swear off the road and there's a rail guard, you don't hit the tree, you don't die, you just have a wrecked car. And the same thing you can think about enabling constraints, what can we set up in our organization that while we take some risks, that if something goes wrong, we don't really kind of hit the tree essentially. And what this means is the vertical slice, the slice of functionality, this increment is really a powerful enabling constraint because this thing proves that our engineering process is working, that our integration processes are working, our testing processes are working, our people are able to collaborate with each other. On the other hand, we can also then show it to our end user and ask them, is this is what you have been looking for? And they can give us feedback on that. And if all of this is yes, 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 then we are in a really good position. And if you think back to one of the principles in the Agile Manifesto is working product is the only measure of progress. And guess what? We have working product every single sprint.
The choice that you mentioned value, right? It's about making choices. The problem I have often is, you know, I have a clear vision for Scrum.org, usually, not always clear, but usually it sort of becomes clearer. And then I have a bunch of things that we can do to deliver against that vision. And how do you understand about value? How do you measure value? How do you identify value? Is it really a gap? You talked a little bit about, hey, it's going to make somebody's life a little bit better. But, you know, how does that really work?
I'm with you here right now. And you know what? When I talked before, I didn't answer that because that would be the 3V, the validation. How do we know that we did it right? So once we have decided, committed on doing something, the next thing is, how would we know that we have been successful? How can we measure that? So it's really about bringing in metrics, hard facts. And this is the validation. That's one of the things which Scrum.org developed, which I really like, and it's EBM, evidence-based management. How can I bring in the evidence that my decisions were right? Or maybe wrong. I mean, it's then we could learn again from that and take it from that. And EBM has those four key value areas where we have current value, that means market share, happiness of our users, along those lines, then unrealized value where we see maybe opportunities, what could we improve, where there's a satisfaction gap, if we could bring something in that it would be really good. So current value and unrealized value have a clear market focus, so kind of customer orientation. And then there are two other ones, which I think many organizations don't really value enough, because it's one is ability to innovate. How innovative can we really be? If you spend so much money, how much of this money really ends up in functionality, or how much money gets lost along the way? Now think about like a big pipe watering a big field. And there's holes in there because it's old and rusty. You know, how much water do you lose along the way? And this is what I just mentioned when you talk about, you know, good test automation, good integration system, build pipelines, all of those things, if they prove your engineering, your wiring underneath internal capabilities is working right. And another one, the fourth key value area is time to market. Let's say we have the world's best idea since sliced bread. How long would it take until the customer has it in their hands? And this is really, now if you have a classic organization, you just mentioned, well, we work 9 months along those lines and this is how we do it. And if you have the world's best idea, you look at 9 months, maybe a little bit more. But in a natural environment, just we can pivot and just say, wow, this happened. Competition launched that, we need to act on that. Okay, we sit down, we come up with an idea a couple of days later, and then we start acting on that, delivering this other vertical slice of functionality, make sure it's right, and then we can ship it. And that's really, in my opinion, what business agility is all about.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the very name, right? Business agility, it's about being able to respond rapidly to the environment in which you're in, and evidence-based management, those measures that you described, the KVA, KVM, in particular, are really good ways of getting that cycle going. But it unfortunately requires a level of discipline in the organization to start capturing those things and talking about those things, which can be really, really hard. One thing that I've seen a lot recently is the trend in OKRs and goals. You know, this in one way of trying to pair goals with measures, which is what OKRs ultimately are about. And there's so how does goals, you know, how important are goals in terms of setting this journey in motion and making it actually executable by the organizations and by the teams?
I think they're really important. I'm a big fan of OKRs, assuming they are done right in the way they have been originally described. Because this is our orientation, because if we don't have a clear goal, we just do busy work. And it looks good because people are running around doing a lot of things, but it's not directed. Now, and this is the thing about having a clear vision about the product. I think that's really important. And then in Scrum, we would have the next smaller goal, a product goal, let's say 4, 5, 6 months down the road. Now in July, I would like to have this and this in place. And again, that's something we can put our teeth in, and this is what we want to achieve. And along as we go there with regards to our sprint goals, and as we all know, a sprint goal should always describe an outcome, never just be a long shopping list. So if we achieve this outcome, or then we would know we achieved it, yes or no. And then if we know yes, great, and let's look for the next one. And then we do this until we achieve the bigger goal, the product goal, and we keep on doing this from product goal until we reach our vision. And by doing this, we get this measurability. And in the PSPOA training, we talk about something what we call the product wall. It's like this dashboard where all crucial information from our product we're working on is visible. And you know, this is, you bring in EBM, you bring in your impact map, your users, story, kind of all of that together. And then you have this one shop stopping place where you could put anyone in front of just say, this is what we're doing right now. And these are the things we are looking for. And this is how we measure. And right now we are here. You know, and Agile is also about creating transparency. And I think this is really beautiful transparency, because then people should hopefully have the impression, wow, these guys are good. They know what they're doing. I think my money is well invested.
And maybe they'll have some feedback as well. I remember at TaskTalk, when I was running product there, we had a product wall in Confluence. And we the great thing about it was when I wheeled it out is I'd get feedback, like particularly from Mick Kerson, Neil and Chosky, some of the key stakeholders, never a VC, they never gave feedback. They just said, why is there no more sales? But the and it was really, really good, because, and sometimes it was a little embarrassing, because I'm like, why didn't I ask that before? So having that thing can be incredibly useful for it. And And I guess all of what we've been talking about, Ralph, is product ownership and product owner, right? So
Yeah.
this person, it's a very, very, and I'm a little biased here, so I apologize, but it's a very, very crucial role to navigate this transformation in this age where complexity is much higher and digital provides us with this ability to do things much quicker and much better. So what is the role of the product owner in this?
Essentially, everything I have talked about, this is for me true product ownership. And I'd like to talk more about ownership, like doing instead of having a role, really being accountable for those things, bringing the business strategy down onto the ground by doing all of that, closing the feedback loops, using empirical process controls, and sticking out your neck once in a while and taking an educated risk.
And I think the key point that you said was, it really isn't a role necessarily in the classical sense. It is a set of accountabilities. It could be played by general manager. It could be played by project manager, even or program manager. It could be played by product manager, depending on the organization and the like. The key thing is that they bring together company vision, business strategy, and make it executable in the context of this product, this bound set of value that we're delivering to the market.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool, Ralph. It's been an absolute pleasure. I could talk for hours about this, but we try to keep these a little short. I've already run over my normal time box. Damn it. But I'm doing my best.
We could
Thank
always do
you.
another one if you don't mind, but I hear you.
Yes, we
Yeah.
could, and yes, we should. And I'd love to lean in particular to the actually what a product owner does on a day-to-day basis, because I think that is something that we need to explore more, because it is an incredibly challenging role.
It
And
is.
I say that from my own experience, because everybody hates me. You know, the developers hate me because I'm setting unrealistic or well, that's not what I would do goals. The stakeholders hate me because I'm trying to manage a balanced portfolio of choices, in a con and then the people that pay for it hate me because, of course, they could just knock this up in PowerPoint, and why would we need anything else, you know? So it's a very challenging role. So maybe I'll take you up on that, Ralph. So, but thank you for
Absolutely, yeah.
spending the time talking to us. Hopefully, the listeners got a lot out of it. So my biggest takeaways where we continue to see a big disconnect between business strategy and the actual goals, plans, and work being done by teams. This is, you know, this is described by Ralph as the vacuum of product management, and I think that really vacuum's a really interesting word because it sucks things in, which is I think what tends to happen in filling this vacuum. Sucks things a lot of work that isn't necessarily as valuable as we would want. Product ownership sits in this space, this intersection between the business and the solution, the technology, which means that ultimately they're responsible for making that strategy real for both the customers, but also more importantly, perhaps for the organization, the team, you know, because, you know, there's that these people are the people that will be delivering ultimately the value. Ralph introduced us or made us reminded us of the three V's: vision, value, and validation, and how Scrum ultimately enables the execution of those V's in these things that we call sprints, and how that process is empirical and drives us to value. Introduced us some of the ideas of EBM and those four areas to use as mechanisms to drive those conversations and highlight those measures. And of course, we finished with, oh my gosh, the product owner. That's hard. And it
It's the perfect
really
ending, in
is.
my opinion. We do
And
never wrong if we end with the product owner.
never wrong when you start and end with the product owner. So
Exactly.
exactly. Well, thanks for joining. And for our audience, thanks for listening today. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, share with your friends, and of course, come back and listen to some more. We're lucky enough to have a variety of guests. It was my pleasure to have Ralph Yocum PST from Switzerland, joining us today and talking to us about product ownership and really this product management vacuum. But there's also many other things that you can hear on this series in the areas of professional Scrum, product thinking, and of course, Agile. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hopefully, you're going to hear me again in the future. And Scrum on.